鬼岛之音
Ghost Island Media。
Today's episode is supported by the Institute for National Defense and Security Research in Taiwan, a think tank dedicated to fueling knowledge-based policy analyses and strategic assessments on Taiwan's security.
$8.17 million votes, a victory for the history books. When Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen won her second term of office on the night of January 11, Taiwan marked a few milestones. The winning ticket, Madam Tsai, and her running mate, William Lai, won with a record number of votes in any presidential race in Taiwan. It was also a record number of votes for the presidential ticket fielded by their party, the Democratic Progressive Party. Voter turnout at 74.9% was the highest in a decade for any national-level election. For Taiwan, the vote is a win for democracy. It has only been 23 years since Taiwan started direct presidential elections. The big vote, which also included all 113 seats up for grabs in parliament, has been praised for its transparent vote counting and, in some cases, gracious concessions on races well run. Welcome to the post-election talk. You've asked on Twitter, we've heard you. In this episode, we look at what still puzzles our listeners. This is a national election, and it has international consequences. What's next for this island of 23 million? These are global issues, and this is The Taiwan Take. I'm your host, J.R. Wu.
Tsai Ing-wen, when she was chair of the DPP during the big local election defeat of 2018, they were hit hard on local issues. But this election became very focused on Taiwan's sovereignty. So I think a lot of people came out in support of the country that they want to live in.
Today, we speak with Chris Horton, a veteran correspondent based in Taipei. He writes for prominent names like the New York Times, The Atlantic, Nikkei Asian Review, and more. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi, JR. Thanks for having me.
You've been in Taiwan since the last election. What are your thoughts this time?
So I arrived shortly after the last election. This was my first presidential and legislative election to cover. But I've been here for 4 years now. I was at Tsai's inauguration.
So that was like the inauguration of Taiwan's first female president back in May 2016.
That's correct. You know, having lived in China and Hong Kong prior to living in Taiwan, I was impressed in particular by just the orderly, peaceful transition of power from one KMT president to the DPP president. It was also very Taiwanese. You know, you had people dressed as boba tea, dancing with baseball players on stage. But there was a very solemn aspect to it where, you know, you could tell that Taiwan has been through a lot in its past and it treasures and values its democracy.
So what was going on that historic night?
On January 11th, it was a huge turnout. I had gone into it thinking that a big turnout would probably go the DPP's way. I think a lot of people on both sides were nervous, but, you know, there were concession speeches from members of both parties that highlighted that Taiwan's democracy is healthy and there's a respect for the institution of democracy here that maybe might not exist in other older democracies. I thought Han Kuo-yu's concession speech was during his campaign, he was very, I wouldn't say mudslinging, but he was definitely fiery and maybe not as respectful to his opponent as he was in his concession speech. So that was a reassuring thing. He could have set a possibly nastier tone that might have led to people looking at Taiwan's democracy as something that's not as stable as it is.
And Han Kuo-yu, I mean, he was a first-time candidate for the KMT in that he got 38.6% of the national vote versus Tsai's 57.1%. That was in some ways, an achievement for his party as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, he got 5.5 million votes compared to Tsai's 8.1. He did much better than Zhu Liluan, the previous KMT candidate that Tsai defeated 4 years ago.
Now, we've had a lot of our listeners ask about voter breakdown, especially the young voters. There's all this analysis since the January 11 vote on how young people came out to cast their ballot. What did you see?
Well, there was definitely a high turnout. I spoke to a lot of young people prior to the vote, and they tend to lean green or more towards the DPP or smaller parties that maintain a Taiwanese identity rather than an ethnic Chinese identity. And for people that aren't so familiar with Taiwanese politics, it's not liberals versus conservatives. It's people who identify more as ethnically as Chinese or who have this Taiwanese identity. I've heard many stories of younger friends having difficulty sitting down at the dinner table with their parents and having a civil conversation about politics. Unlike 4 years ago, this time there was a bit of vitriol coming from the blue side. And I think part of that is I spoke to a woman at the last An Guoyu and Kuomintang rally outside of Chiang Kai-shek Memorial. And
in Taipei.
Yes, here in Taipei. She had just taken a photo of Chiang Kai-shek's statue. She was all decked out in Republic of China memorabilia, clothing and hats. Her dog, a very cute little dog, had a little ROC flag, Republic of China flag outfit that it was wearing. And for her, she said, if Han Kuo-yu doesn't win, then that will be the death of the ROC. So basically, the difference between the blue and the green side of the political spectrum here is on the blue side, they believe that Taiwan is part of a country called the Republic of China. On the green side, these people think of Taiwan as Taiwan, even though it's not officially a country called Taiwan. That's the country that they live in. And in a way, you could call it like a civil war of sorts, because the status of Taiwan is still undetermined. So people came out to vote for the country that they wanted to live in.
Chris, going into the election, there was a lot of concern about polling accuracy, whether or not the polls really were taking the pulse of the country. It turns out they were pretty accurate. We can't say this in all elections around the world either. So what happened in Taiwan?
Well, yeah, the polls were accurate, but there was definitely a lot of doubt.
One of our listeners did ask, was Tsai Ing-wen really trailing in the polls at one point?
Well, I mean, you would have to have a vote at that point to determine whether or not the polls were accurate. It definitely seemed like her fortunes earlier in
2019.
Yeah, in 2019, were it seemed like she was definitely in trouble. Her vice presidential running mate, William Lai, you know, he challenged her in the primary. I would say, actually, that was really good for her. That was a big turning point for her.
It's almost democratic in nature. I mean, it shows that you can have a contest within your own party and then go into the national elections with that former opponent.
Yeah, it's very democratic. And they came together when during crunch time. But last spring, when he challenged her, that put her into campaign mode, put her on the offensive. And actually, I would say that's when Tsai's at her best, when she's on the ropes.
Because this is a politician, Taiwan's first female president. That's no easy feat. She also brought her party back from the depths of despair back in 2008 after the KMT trumped her party. And then she came back and won them the presidency in 2016, 8 years later.
Yes, she's been around for a while, not so much as an elected official, but yes, as the head of the party twice, I believe. And she was a World Trade Organization negotiator. So she's familiar with politics and how things work here in Taipei.
Do you think young people believe in her, given the results of the vote?
I would say young people believe that she's more capable of defending Taiwan than either Han Kuo-yu or James Song. If you look at the local elections in 2018, in which the DPP was beaten pretty badly by the KMT, I think a lot of the voter dissatisfaction on the green side that led many people to switch to a blue vote, that stemmed from high expectations of Tsai Ing-wen that hadn't been fulfilled. There are issues like same-sex marriage that the government had been dragging its feet on. A lot of young people spoke to me and said, you know, that was an issue for them. Then there was also the palpable improvement of living standards. Young people here, they don't make a lot of money, most of them.
So, Chris, when you say you talk to a lot of young people, you speak Mandarin?
Yes, I do.
Do they speak in Mandarin or in English to you?
Either one.
Now I'm going to give you a tougher question. So a lot of our listeners have also wondered. Last year, it was the Hong Kong protests. Last year, Chinese President Xi Jinping has had to deal with the U.S.-China trade war, has had to deal with human rights issues regarding Xinjiang. That boosts the DPP going into an election, and we saw the results, no?
I would say, you know, with the local elections in 2018, people are thinking much more locally. They're not worried about issues of national sovereignty. But, you know, since the first presidential election in 1996, when China was firing missiles at the Taiwanese coast, you know, sovereignty and protecting the nation, whatever nation you think it is, the Republic of China or Taiwan, has always been the core issue. So, of course, you know, they might have added a little wind to Tsai and the DPP's sails, but I don't think they were decisive. I think if you look a little more locally, the KMT party list, which is, for people that aren't familiar with Taiwan's electoral system, they might not understand how important the party list was to the DPP. You know, it gave the DPP a huge point of attack, and also it really detracted from whatever momentum the KMT had going into the election.
Now, before we get into all these party lists, as I understand, there's cosplay, there's death metal band, lead man as one of the candidates, all those fun things. Let me just ask you this one question about international media coverage of this election. Many times, folks parachute in, super smart, China hands. But sometimes they look at these issues from a China lens. Is there a Taiwan angle here that we're missing?
Well, yeah, I think this is a great question. I think a lot of international media coverage, and rightly so, you know, it focuses on the China angle to Taiwanese elections. But there's also, you know, it often overlooks this internal struggle between people who think they live in Taiwan and people who think they live in the Republic of China. You know, 1945 is when the Republic of China arrived after Japan's surrender in World War II. 2 years later, Taiwanese people rose up violently against the KMT and the Republic of China government. They were suppressed even more violently.
Martial law was imposed soon after that.
Yeah, that which basically wiped out as many as 28,000 Taiwanese, most of whom were the kinds of people that would have run an independent Taiwanese government. So you have Japanese-trained civil servants, lawyers, judges, doctors, those types of people. So there was 38 years of martial law that followed the retreat or the rebasing of the Republic of China government from Nanjing to Taipei after the Communist Revolution. That ended in 1987. In 1992, the first legislative elections were held. 1996, the first presidential election. And the first time that a non-KMT president was elected was 2000. That was Chen Shui-bian. He was reelected in 2004. But both of those terms, he was facing a KMT-controlled parliament, KMT-controlled legislative yuan.
The internal domestic struggle as Taiwan became a democracy. This is really important for folks looking at Taiwan and looking at Taiwan-China to understand and not just see it from the PRC point of view, right? Because
right.
PRC has not gone through any of this upheaval to get to a directly elected government.
That's true. And for me, 2016 was a very big moment when Tsai Ing-wen won the presidential election, but the DPP took control of the legislative yuan for the first time.
That was historic.
Yeah, that and the fact that both were able to hold on this election shows that this Taiwanese identity is really taking hold. So for China hands, China watchers, this is a major development. But it is an internal development. Taiwan has 23.5 million people and a whole range of different opinions about identity and where the country should go.
In all your reporting about the election, what's a quote that stands out most to you?
So one of the quotes in my recent coverage that really stuck out for me was, it ended up in a New York Times article that I wrote with Stephen Lee Myers, who is the Beijing bureau chief, who came down here. And it was from a student named Alan Xu. He's studying for his master's in Chinese University of Hong Kong. That university, like many other universities, has seen police brutality towards students. And when Alan came back, he told me that he felt it was important to cast his vote because he wanted to make sure that 20 years from now, his kids weren't protesting against the CCP in the streets of Taipei.
All right, let's talk about the fun stuff, the cosplay that I was talking about and the heavy metal. Let's shift our focus to the legislative race, where there were some color going on there. Some of our listeners have asked via Twitter, what are some of the biggest surprises?
There were a lot of surprises. In terms of trends, I saw a few that got pointed out by some of the more astute observers of Taiwan politics on Twitter, like Lev Nachman, Michael Turton, Mark Harrison. One thing that happened that was quite significant was the DPP made inroads into the indigenous vote. There's six legislative seats reserved for indigenous Taiwanese. And typically they vote for the KMT, sometimes independent. But the DPP, until this election, had never had a legislative seat within the indigenous vote. So that was a small but significant surprise.
And as I understand it as well, in the outlying islands, Jingmen and Mazu, even though the DPP suffered defeat there, which was expected, they actually increased their percentage of vote compared to 2016 as well.
Yes, it was a small but significant shift. You know, the outlying islands of Jinmen and Mazu, they're very close to China. They're like pure ROC, okay? You know, they were never colonized along with Taiwan and Penghu by Japan. They didn't participate in the struggle for democracy. Martial law in Jinmen didn't end until 1992, just before the first direct legislative elections. So for them, you know, they went straight from martial law to democracy. The significant thing about Jinmen and Mazu going a little bit more green means that even in these places that, you know, they can literally see China, they're that close, they feel China's gravitational pull quite a bit more than they do Taiwan, which is hundreds of kilometers away. For these two counties to be going more green than before indicates, even in these most Chinese parts of the ROC, you have a growing Taiwanese identity. I think some of that is due to young people coming to mainland Taiwan to study at university. And, you know, they get involved in activism and different organizations, and they talk to people who definitely feel Taiwanese, and that Taiwanese identity takes root in them as well.
Hi. If you've enjoyed the Taiwan Take, you can give us a good rating on Apple Podcasts. This helps other listeners find the show. If you have a news tip, tweet at us at Ghost Island Me. For dollar tips, we take monthly donations through Patreon. Find us on patreon.com/Taiwan. Back to our interview.
So cherry pick, Chris. Frontline, a YouTuber winning for the first time against a political dynasty, the youngest lawmaker for Taiwan, a death metal candidate. Gosh, tell us more about the color in the parliament election.
I mean, one of the more interesting developments in the legislative race was the emergence of a pan-green coalition known as the Frontline, or Qianqian in Chinese. So Freddie Lim is probably the best-known member of this five-person group.
This is that lead singer.
Yes, he's the lead singer of a metal band called Thonic. He's also proven himself to be a very good speaker as a legislator. He was originally with the New Power Party, which sprouted out of the Sunflower Movement in 2014.
And he was also with Amnesty International.
Yeah, when the legislative UN was debating whether or not to legalize same-sex marriage here, he gave one of the most passionate and emphatic defenses in favor of legalization. But Freddie is just one of the members of the front line. Lai Ping-Yu, I believe his assistant in the New Power Party, they both left shortly before the election. She's 27 years old. She became the youngest legislator elected in Taiwan's history. She's been an activist for 10 years, very well known for that. Also very well known for her cosplay. I went to a frontline rally December, I believe. It was just outside the presidential office, and you had Freddie Lim's band performing, and that was quite something. I'm not really a metalhead, but it was pretty amazing. A friend of mine was visiting from the States and could not believe that this was
a lawmaker.
Not just a lawmaker, but that this was like a rally that also, you know, was attended by President Tsai, who definitely was doing everything she could to promote the frontline candidates, another one of whom she especially focused at the end of the campaign on Enoch Wu, who comes from an interesting background.
Now, before you go on, Chris, full disclaimer here, Enoch Wu is the brother of the producer of this podcast. Go on.
So Enoch Wu was not really expected to defeat his opponent in the Taipei legislative district that he was running in. That candidate, Wayne Jiang, is the great-grandson of Chiang Kai-shek. So that's royalty, you know, that's blue blood.
Now, he also comes from a very strong background going against the great-grandson of Chiang Kai-shek. He's a former special forces for Taiwan, and he also comes from an investment banking background in the international investment banking. So it was a really close race. I remember hearing their victory and their concession speeches, respectively, both gentlemen.
Enoch, he had come from this investment banking background, 10 years in Hong Kong. He'd gone to Yale, and then he came back and joined Special Forces and worked in the National Security Council. He was able to take that national security background and this expertise that he has in it. He focused especially on a KMT party list candidate named Wu Sihuai.
Now, for our listeners, this parliamentary race, I'll let you talk more about it. You're much more expert at this. But there is a legislator at large list for any of the parties. And pretty much they're ranked from first, second, third, depending on the list. And they're shooed into parliament depending on the percentage of votes their party gets.
That's correct. Yeah. So basically, in this election, everybody voted three times. The first vote was for the president and vice president. The second vote was for your district's legislature.
Where you live. Yep.
Yes. And then the third one was just a general party vote. And that party vote, you know, it's designed to enable proportional representation, which benefits smaller parties, right?
So, but what it also means is that the people on that list are not actually being directly elected by their constituents.
Right.
And Wu Sihuai, what was going on with this issue?
Well, Wu Sihuai he's a retired ROC general who has come out in favor of unification with China. He has visited China since retirement. In 2016, he attended a speech given by Chinese leader Xi Jinping. He even sang the PRC national anthem. So he's viewed as very pro-China. And the KMT, they surprised a lot of people with how pro-China their party list was. He was in the number four position. That's basically going to guarantee that he gets in.
And he did get in. Sure. For our listeners, so what? He has these views. This is a democracy. Why not? And it comes to what committees he may be sitting in parliament, or a lawmaker who is a shoo-in who is not voted by constituents, what access to national security information they'll be seeing.
Right. And that was a major talking point for Enoch Wu. He led this campaign to demand that the KMT remove Wu Sihuai from their party list. It was unsuccessful in terms of its primary goal, but other DPP candidates also echoed this sentiment. There were billboards all around Taiwan basically demanding that Wu Sihuai be removed from the KMT party list. That didn't happen, but you know, Enoch Wu, who lost by a narrow margin to Wayne Jiang, he made a name for himself with this election.
Now, moving on from the Battle of the Hunks, at least that was one of the headlines that I saw for that particular race. How about the young YouTuber who won for the first time? What was that one about?
Well, Chen Bowei is his name. He was also at that frontline rally that I went to. He was a very good speaker. He knew how to make a crowd laugh. And he took on a dynasty. So he won in Taichung's District 2. And his opponent was from the KMT. Name is Yan Quanheng, the son of Yan Qingbiao, who had previously been a legislator in that district. And he's known for his connection to organized crime and the biggest Mazu temple in Taichung, which hosts the biggest Mazu parade. And
this is Taichung in central Taiwan, one of the bigger cities in central Taiwan.
Well, it's the second most populous city in the country, yeah. So that's a big victory. What's really remarkable about Chen Bo-wei's victory is that not only did he take out a rival who had local connections, literally and figuratively, but he was the first member of this Taiwan State Building Party to be elected to the legislature.
And this is a freshly minted party. It's so brand new, it's still shining.
Yes, this is a so-called third force party, which, you know, these are green parties that came out of the Sunflower Movement, parties that might find the DPP to be a little bit too conservative for their tastes. I mean, as their name says, state building. They envision a Taiwanese state. And, from the other side of the strait, people would probably call that Taiwanese independence.
Tsai had this big victory, but it was some of these political parties, newly established even, that surprisingly came in with really good results.
Yeah, the Taiwan People's Party performed quite well. So the DPP got 34% of the party vote. The KMT got 33.3% of the party vote. The TPP, which is Taipei Mayor Ko Wen-jo's new party, it was formed just this past year. He's chairman. They got 11.2% of the vote. That gave them 5 seats in the 113-seat legislature.
So then when it comes to Mayor Ko and his Taiwan People's Party, how is he going to change the dynamic, or how is his party going to change the dynamic of parliament now?
Well, that's a good question. The main platform that they've been running on is we're not the DPP or the KMT. The TPP, the Taiwan People's Party, it's now the third largest party in the legislature. And we really don't know how they're going to affect votes because they haven't really, well, first of all, they've never fielded legislative candidates before. And second of all, there's not really a consistent message coming out of the TPP camp.
It'll be really interesting to watch. I mean, Mayor Ke, he's actually a doctor by training, but he has been running Taipei City, which is Taiwan's largest metropolis, for almost 4 years now, unlike Han Kuo-yu, who got voted in as Kaohsiung mayor and immediately went on to stump for himself as president. So all these politicians in Taiwan have strong personalities. But what does that mean for Tsai and her second term? She has to deal with all these personalities.
Well, actually, to be factually correct, Taipei is the fourth largest city in Taiwan.
They split it already? Darn it.
Yeah, the largest in terms of population is New Taipei City. The second is Taichung. The third is Kaohsiung. And the fourth is the fair capital.
You are a Taiwanese, Chris. So what does it mean for Tsai's second term?
Well, I think she's got momentum. They definitely have a mandate. It was a very convincing win, both in terms of her presidential victory and the DPP holding on to the legislature. I think the TPP could swing either way, green or blue, depending on what they're voting on. It's really too early to say. But I think now the DPP, the key will be keeping people in line. I think crucial to that will be the continued presence of Premier Su Zhengchang. Su highlighted a lot of the Tsai administration's successes, including the prevention of African swine fever, which is spread all over East and Southeast Asia, from entering Taiwan. And he should be able to maintain party unity for another. I'm presuming he'll stay on as premier for at least another year or two. If he does that, expect the DPP to be able to get a lot of things done.
Now, get a lot of things done. What about ties with China, ties with the U.S.? What's your sense there? Military, security, and economy.
Well, ties with China, I think, as Tsai said, you know, like, look, cross-strait relations, there's two parties to this thing, you know, and Taiwan is willing to negotiate or talk to China, you know, as equals. China refuses to accept this. They demand that she accept the 1992 consensus, which posits that Taiwan is part of China. And for her, that's just a non-starter. That's basically giving up Taiwanese sovereignty. So I would expect Chile relations, at least politically, across the strait. And Tsai, one thing that she's doing is her new southbound policy that has been in effect for 4 years now. It's focused on reducing Taiwan's economic reliance on China. I would expect that to continue. This trade war as well, Taiwan has been one of the big beneficiaries of the trade war. And I think she's going to keep trying to get Taiwanese companies to either divert investment from China back to Taiwan or even move operations or personnel, while also focusing on increasing Taiwan's economic footprint and interactions with Southeast Asia.
And with Washington?
With Washington, well, I'm sure they're going to keep their options open, you know, keep good relations with the Trump administration, while also making sure that they have some sort of contact with the eventual Democratic Party nominee. I think arms sales are likely to continue for the next 4 years.
What role do you think the KMT has in these next 4 years to either help or hinder this administration?
So the KMT is now kind of facing its recurring existential question. Are we going to try to make ourselves Taiwanese, or are we going to continue on this Chinese-ness platform? For the KMT, their name in Chinese is the Zhongguo Guomindang, the China Nationalist Party or Chinese Nationalist Party. Maybe younger KMT members would be interested in considering a change to the Taiwan Nationalist Party or just getting rid of the China from the name.
But, are you suggesting, or have some of those members kind of told you they're considering that?
Nobody's told me. I've just seen this in recent media reports that getting rid of this overarching Chinese-ness of the KMT identity and trying to localize it and make it more Taiwanese is the best way forward for the party, you know, according to them. But then you have older people, they hold the levers of power within the party, and they're not having any of that.
Chris, it's been fantastic hearing your insights, and truly, you do sound more Taiwanese than I do sometimes. What are you working on?
Well, I'm hopefully going to go on a bike trip soon and get out to see some of the Taiwanese countryside, which is one of my favorite things to do here. That's my short-term project.
How do we read more of your work?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm fairly active. My handle is my Chinese name, He Guisen. So it's at H-E-G-U-I-S-E-N.
Chris, thank you so much for sharing your insights today.
Thank you, JR. I've really enjoyed being here and look forward to coming back sometime.
I'm JR Wu, and this is The Taiwan Take.
This has been a Ghost Island Media production based in Taipei, Taiwan. This episode was produced and edited by me, Emily Y. Wu. Sam Robbins is our production assistant. Additional help today from Harley Sentner. Brand design by Thomas Lee. Thanks for listening. See you next time.